Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Life in Movies, Stories from 50 Years in Hollywood, by Irwin Winkler. Narrated by Michael Butler Murray. Part 1. When I walked onto the MGM lot in Culver City in January 1966, it was not the MGM I had imagined. When I was growing up, the MGM lion roared, promising the greatest movie stars, tuneful musicals, inspirational family dramas, and an occasional comedy or period film. It was America in all its small-town wholesomeness. No accident that the families in Meet Me in St. Louis or the Andy Hardy series featured happy, secure, middle-class white fathers and mothers who never seemed to have a job other than taking care of the household and children. However, you never did see a pregnant woman or a gay man or woman. The MGM musicals were glamorous, inventive, and brought the great composers, Irving Berlin, Aaron Copland, George and Ira Gershwin, Cole Porter, to a mass audience. They also brought unbelievably talented dancers, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, Sid Charisse, vocalists, Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra, Debbie Reynolds, even Olympic swimmers, Esther Williams, and the movie stars, Clark Gable, Greta Garbo, Mickey Rooney, Joan Crawford, Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy, Greer Garson, Walter Pidgeon, Van Johnson, Lana Turner, all working for Mr. Mayer and company. For every nook and corner of America, there was a film a week, 52 a year. MGM boasted hundreds of actors under multi-year exclusive contracts, schools for the child actors, Elizabeth Taylor, Mickey Rooney, dance classes, elocution lessons, doctors, dentists, barbers, bankers, chiropractors, and a team of masseuses to soothe the bodies of the executives and stars. The back lot, a couple of miles south of the main studio, had an authentic-looking French town with a lake and a moat. Why travel all the way to Europe? A New York City street? Why go east? A small-town Andy Hardy village, a railroad station, and an MGM-owned and operated generator plant, so MGM didn't have to depend on the city for its power. Storage facilities housed the valuable antiques that were used on sets, costumes from janitor overalls to glamorous gowns, even jewels for actors to flash. A large group of ex-Los Angeles police officers made up the security force to protect the actors and executives, who might themselves get into trouble on or, more probably, off the lot. By 1966, most of that was gone. The man whose name was over the lion, Louis B. Mayer, was also gone, and an auction was soon to sell off the costumes, the props, and the real estate. A few television shows were renting out the sound stages where Gene Kelly had danced with Leslie Caron to George Gershwin's An American in Paris. The once bustling Dream Factory was sad and sparse. Movies thrived before and after World War II, but in 1947 the United States government broke up the ownership of the theaters and the studios. No longer could the movie makers control where the films played, and no longer could the movie theaters control the films that were produced. Television soon came along, and by the time I showed up at MGM, more than 90% of the homes in America had TV sets. As television audiences grew, movie attendance shrank. In the 1940s, almost 60% of America went to the movies once a week. By 1965, only 10% went that often. Not only MGM, but all of the once powerful studios had experienced a radical upheaval. In 1958, the talent agency MCA took over Universal Studios, primarily to produce television shows through the subsidiary Review Productions. 20th Century Fox had lost its leader, Daryl Zanuck, and to keep the movie studio running, sold most of its backlot, known now as Century City. In October 1966, Paramount was sold to Gulf and Western, a conglomerate run by a very shady Charles Bludorn. Warner Brothers Studio, despite winning an Academy Award for Best Picture with My Fair Lady in 1965, ended up in the hands of the New York parking lot owner Steve Ross, after Jack Warner sold it to a small company, Seven Arts. Columbia Pictures lost its leader, the autocratic, much-hated Harry Cohn, in 1958. At his funeral, the actor Red Skelton, upon seeing the massive turnout, remarked, "Give the public what they want, and they'll come out for it." Columbia Pictures was on the verge of bankruptcy until the mid-1960s, when a young producer, Bert Schneider, made a bunch of successful low-budget movies, starting with Easy Rider. The Walt Disney Company we know now as one of the, if not the, most successful entertainment companies in the world was a mere shell of what it had been in the glory days of Mickey Mouse and the Seven Dwarves, as Walt Disney himself died on December 15, 1966. When I stepped out of my dilapidated car and looked up at the MGM sign, I was in awe. But when I walked around the lot trying to find my office, I ended up in the barber shop, where Slick the Shoeshine Man, who, I was told, had been shining shoes at MGM since the 1930s, pointed me to the Thalberg Building, named after the creative head of MGM's glory days, Irving Thalberg, who died in 1936. That seemed to be all that was left of an era when the studio's motto was, "More stars than there are in heaven." The MGM sign, without the lion, now sits atop a small office building on Beverly Drive in the commercial district of Beverly Hills, just one block east of the much more famous and glamorous Rodeo Drive. No lot, no sound stages. As I wrote this memoir, we finished shooting Creed II, a spin-off of the Rocky series with Michael B. Jordan and Sylvester Stallone, and The Irishman, the story of mob hitman Frank Sheeran with Marty Scorsese directing Bob De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci. Both Creed II and The Irishman prove that, although the dream factories may be gone, the dreams live on. Chapter 1. From Coney Island to William Morris to Hollywood. My introduction to show business came via a circuitous route. Don't many important things in life? Growing up in Coney Island, I played and worked on the famous boardwalk, selling hot dogs and cotton candy, and taking tickets for kiddie rides. Whenever I had free time, I would end up in one of the two local movie theaters. The one that showed mostly MGM films was the favorite for dates. Those were the romances and the musicals in blazing color. The other movie houses showed the much tougher Warner Brothers, James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart gangster films. For those films, no dates. I graduated from high school early and was 17 and a half when I entered New York University. It was 1949, and NYU was crowded with mature students who were attending college under the GI Bill. I was lost, had few friends, didn't like school, and after a couple of years I enlisted in the United States Army, figuring if I couldn't study with soldiers, I'd fight alongside them. The infantry unit I was assigned to in Camp Polk, Louisiana, was training for duty in Korea, where the North Koreans had invaded South Korea. A useless war, in which 52,000 Americans died, and we seemed to be at it again. When our sergeant asked if anyone could type, I raised my hand, figuring it would be a lot better than schlepping a 40-pound mortar on my back. They discovered I wasn't the greatest typist in the Army. But before they might have sent me to the ice-cold front lines, I luckily became indispensable when I located some misplaced service records of Korean-assigned infantrymen. After my discharge, I returned to NYU a lot more grown up than when I'd left. One of the classes I signed up for was Contemporary American Literature. The instructor was a Professor Leahy, who introduced me to John Steinbeck, Ernest Hemingway, John Dos Passos, William Faulkner, and F. Scott Fitzgerald. I was engrossed in the creativity of these writers, and instead of an indifferent student who joined the army to get away from studying, I became a constant presence in the library as I consumed book after book until I graduated. When I was a student at New York University, I had a lengthy subway ride from Coney Island in Brooklyn, where I lived, to Manhattan. To take a break from studying the great American writers, I picked up a pulp fiction novel, The Carpetbaggers by Harold Robbins, about the early pioneers in the film industry, from the Nickelodeon to the modern day, at the time 1958. I was intrigued, read the book twice, and remembered I had grown up with a fellow who always looked great in a black suit, white shirt and tie, who was with MCA, then a renowned talent agency. Upon graduating from NYU a short time later, I had to get a job. Remembering the carpetbaggers and not knowing any better, I called and somehow got an interview for a job in the MCA mailroom. Going from the reception area to my interview, I passed a couple of the black-suited agents who were on the phone in animated conversations, and I caught snippets of one talking to Bert, who I realized was Bert Lancaster, another to Tony, who was Tony Curtis. And I thought, wow, this is a lot better than my father's cotton goods business. The interview, however, wasn't wow. Far from it. I was asked a dozen questions, none of which I answered with any knowledge. I was quickly shown the door and told, why didn't I try that other agency, William Morris? At William Morris, a very sweet receptionist handed me an application form, and after a short wait, the head of the mailroom, sure enough, asked me pretty much the same questions as the MCA fellow. But now, I knew what not to say. I was hired for 8 weeks at $40 per week to fill in for summer vacationing messenger boys, no women, with the understanding that I would be let go when the vacations were over. Fair enough. I was more curious than ambitious. After 6 or 7 weeks of sorting mail, I was given a pack of saving bank books in the name of Abe Lastfogel, the head man at William Morris. I was instructed to take each one of the 20 to 30 savings bank books to different banks all over Manhattan and Brooklyn and have the interest on the savings accounts entered. It seemed Mr. Lastfogel didn't trust any one bank with all his money and was also protecting himself from multiple bank failures, so he deposited the maximum amount protected by law, $5,000, in each bank. This was the man who was running a giant talent agency, advising clients from Frank Sinatra to Marilyn Monroe to Danny Kaye about their careers. I thought about my degree from NYU and that this procedure certainly wasn't what I'd been taught about economics and financial planning. But Lastfogel was the boss, and I was the mailboy. As Labor Day approached, I was told I would be let go, as all the vacationers were returning. I was starting to enjoy the simplicity of the mailroom and the camaraderie of my colleagues, who included future producers Bernie Brillstein, Jerry Weintraub, and George Shapiro. I was also enjoying the Broadway theater, as a couple of times a week clients would cancel at the last minute, and I got to see and fall in love with the musicals My Fair Lady, Bells Are Ringing, The Most Happy Fella, Auntie Mame, and legit shows like Long Day's Journey Into Night, and Separate Tables. Although that $40 a week didn't give me much to live on, I found myself really liking my little corner of showbiz. As my departure date loomed, I was given an envelope and $4 in cab fare to take a contract to the singer Billy Eckstein for a performance that night. I was told to get it signed and brought right back. I walked from the Morris office on 55th Street to the subway on 59th Street. The express train took me to Eckstein's apartment on 125th Street. He signed the contract, and the express took me back to the office in just about 20 minutes. The office manager accused me of not only pocketing the $4 cab fare, but also forging Eckstein's signature, since it was impossible for me to get back and forth so quickly. I protested and asked him to call Eckstein, who would verify his signature and my credibility. My boss was so embarrassed when Eckstein told him the kid had been there that he kept me on in the mailroom. 25 years later, an old friend, Jerry Parencio, had a birthday party and had Eckstein perform, after which the singer coincidentally sat next to me for dinner. I told him the story of my long-ago trip to his apartment, and he looked at me blankly. The defining moment in my career was a completely insignificant moment in his. I guess it depends on which side of the aisle you're sitting on. Now settled into the mailroom, I had corresponded with a fellow clerk in the Los Angeles William Morris office mailroom. He introduced me to Margot Milson, a beautiful young woman who had recently moved to New York from California. We met at the lounge of the Park Sheraton Hotel right next to the Morris office, had dinner that night, the next night, and, except for a couple of early days, we haven't separated in 60 years. Margot and I had come together in spite of her mother warning her to never marry an agent or a Jew. Margot was brought up in a non-practicing Jewish home by parents who were formerly vaudeville performers. In the early part of the 20th century, before television, radio, and widespread movie-going, vaudeville was the primary source of entertainment in much of the United States. Performances featured an act, be it a juggler, acrobat, singer, comedian, dancer, you name it. The act traveled from city to city, town to town. The performers very often staying in rooming houses that bore signs, "No dogs or Jews allowed." Margot's mother, Irma, went by the name of Irminette, and her act was playing Beethoven violin concertos while on her toes and doing a backbend. She also seriously played at Carnegie Hall. Charlie Melson, Margot's father, was a bandleader who did sand dance, a soft shoe routine on sand spread on the stage. When Margot was growing up, however, these talents were no longer of use, nor was vaudeville. Margot and I married 8 months after we met. Margot's show business genes played well when she had a small part in The Strawberry Statement, one of my earliest movies, right up through Marty Scorsese's After Hours, The King of Comedy, and Goodfellas, as well as Night and the City, The Net, and Guilty by Suspicion. To supplement my meager income from the Morris Office trainee program, I was able to laugh on two live television shows. Both The Walter Winchell Show and The Buddy Hackett Show had me laugh and applaud when the audience didn't. It was pretty often. When a job opened up for a projectionist at William Morris, I applied and found myself running a 16-millimeter projection machine, rather ineptly, and booking auditions in the conference room, including one for Elvis Presley, whom I got to know under very different circumstances, but that's for later, until I was promoted to secretary to an agent in the syndication department. The glamour of showbiz proved very unglamorous when my job consisted of selling foreign rights to half-hour television shows, like Make Room for Daddy starring Danny Thomas and The Dick Van Dyke Show that the Morris office represented. Toward the fifth boring year, I was introduced to the brilliant magazine editor and lifelong friend, Clay Felker. Although I had little background in talent management, I had learned a lot by osmosis, hanging around with the talent agents, reading the odd script, and the like. Because of my Morris office pedigree, Clay asked if I would handle his young and gorgeous wife, the actress Pamela Tiffin. In short order, Clay introduced me to the group of extremely talented writers who represented the new form of journalism. Tom Wolfe, Gloria Steinem, Nick Pileggi, Jimmy Breslin, Gail Sheehy, and Nora Ephron. Clay had assembled that group of writers when he was editor of the New York Herald Tribune and founder of New York Magazine. I was a minor investor. Clay would introduce me to a whole new world, far from the tedium of selling syndication rights, and through Pamela, I was introduced to the world of the movies. Examining my years as a mediocre, and that's an overstatement, agent, I decided to go into the personal management business with Bob Chartoff, a recent graduate of Columbia Law School who had no desire to be a lawyer. Bob and I met one night when one of his clients, the comic Jackie Mason, was on the Ed Sullivan Show and I was covering it for another William Morris agent who was sick. Bob then wanted me to see a singer he was interested in, who was appearing in a club downtown. I didn't think much of the singer, but I thought Bob was interesting, ambitious, and very smart. Bob soon after asked if I would handle Mason at William Morris. We booked Mason into some high-profile clubs and multiple appearances on live variety shows. Bob then suggested I leave William Morris and join him in the management business. I brought into our partnership a few of my clients whom the Morris office had no interest in. One, an Englishman, Nat Cohen, was the producer of Carry On Nurse, one of a series of lowbrow comedies, and some minor television dramas. Bob, of course, had his list of singers and comics. Margot never blinked when I told her I was thinking of leaving my secure job at William Morris for the unknown world of personal management. We had no money and two young boys, Charles and David, Adam was yet to come. But Margot, rather than urging caution, was encouraging when I was unsure. It's been the same ever since. Out of character, Nat Cohen had financed a small feature film called Billy Liar, starring Tom Courtney and the young British actress Julie Christie, directed by John Schlesinger, who later went on to direct Midnight Cowboy. When Cohen signed Christie for Billy Liar, he also got options on her acting services for 6 more films, with the right to lend her out to other films, at a profit, of course. He asked us to represent those loans, or, as he put it, get her a big movie. We found Billy Liar playing at a small art house on Long Island. Watching the movie, Bob and I kept waiting for Julie Christie to show up on screen. After 30 minutes or so, she came bopping down the street, her hair flowing, beautiful face and figure, the epitome of English hip in the mid-1960s. One look at Christie and I poked my partner and said, "Bob, we're gonna be in the movie business." Shortly thereafter, Cohen told us he was financing another film directed by Schlesinger starring Christie, called Darling. And would we help Schlesinger in the casting of Darling when he came to New York? In the meantime, we started looking for a movie for Christie after Darling. We checked all the upcoming films, and I heard about David Lean casting Dr. Zhivago, based on Boris Pasternak's novel about the Russian Revolution. We called Lean and Lee Steiner, who was producer Carlo Ponti's lawyer in New York. Steiner told us to send him a letter on behalf of Julie Christie and that he would pass it on to Ponti. The suggestion of sending a letter seemed pretty much like a brush-off. It wasn't. At least, not after Steiner called and we arranged for Christie to test for the starring role of Laura. Christie's test was successful. She got the part, beating out Jane Fonda. And Cohen asked us to come to London to see the half-completed Darling so that we could advise him on selling the film in the States. The only problem we had at this point was finding the money to get to London. With my 2 small children and Bob's 3, and not all of our clients paying commission, we were living hand-to-mouth. Bob found out about a gambling junket flying from New York to London with a plane load of high rollers, and they must have been short 2 players, because we were off to London in short order. We were put up at a fancy West End hotel and ferried to the Victoria Sporting Club, where we were given dinner and expected to gamble. Bob and I bought $500 in chips, and during the rest of our stay kept cashing in our supposed winnings, buying more chips for the sum of $500, then cashing them in again, looking very active, but really risking nothing. In the meantime, we saw a rough cut of Darling and realized it was not only a very fine film, but cutting-edge cinema that would make Julie Christie a star. Back in New York, we figured that MGM, the financiers behind Dr. Zhivago, would be a natural to buy and distribute Darling in the United States. MGM's CEO, Bob O'Brien, whom we were introduced to by Lee Steiner, thought so too, and said he planned to go to London to see Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, and that we should meet him there and screen Darling for him. Luckily, there was another junket, and back to London we went. O'Brien liked what he saw and agreed to buy the U.S. rights for $1.1 million. Cohen was thrilled, Julie Christie was thrilled, and I guess the Victoria Sporting Club was less so, as we were never able to get on another junket. A couple of weeks after we returned from London the second time, Bob O'Brien asked us to his office and bluntly told us he was not going to go ahead on the Darling deal. It seems he was up for a papal knighthood, and he was sure that when the Catholic Legion of Decency saw the nudity and sexuality in the film, they would condemn it, and him. There was no way of convincing him otherwise, and we dejectedly returned to our office. But in the time we had walked the mere 5 or 6 blocks, the word was out, and a small independent distributor, Joe Levine, who had made his reputation and fortune by distributing Italian epics like Hercules Unchained and some other minor foreign films, had called. Levine had been tipped off that O'Brien was pulling out of Darling, and he offered to buy it sight unseen for $800,000, or if he flew to London and liked it, $1.1 million. When I informed Nat Cohen, he told me to grab the $800,000 as he was sure that Levine would pass on it if he saw the film. To this day, I don't think Joe Levine ever saw Darling. But the film received great critical and audience acclaim. It was nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, and Julie Christie won for Best Actress. Julie Christie went right from the set of Darling to the Madrid set of Dr. Zhivago for an unheard-of 140-week schedule, at a salary of $1,000 per week. Taking into account that Christie had to do post-production work on Darling in London, we negotiated for her to leave the Zhivago location and return to London after 8 weeks. 7 weeks after Christie started Zhivago, I called the head of MGM Business Affairs, Peter Shaw, to give him notice that Christie would be leaving the set that Saturday, as per her contract. Strangely, nothing happened. No response came from Shaw. Days passed, and still no word. So this time I called Ben Milnicker, the head of MGM Business Affairs in New York, and reminded him of Christie's leaving. No response. On that Friday afternoon, Milnicker called, hysterical, and asked us to come to O'Brien's office immediately. When we got there, O'Brien, who sweat a lot normally, was drenched and was on the phone with his production manager in Spain, who told him that Christie was packing and would leave for London the next morning. When O'Brien asked him what they were shooting the next day, he was told, a scene at the Russian train station with 5,000 dress extras and Julie Christie. And she wasn't going to be there. Oh, and David Lean didn't know, because they were afraid to tell him. If they did, they were sure he would walk off the film. O'Brien, wiping his brow with a now-soaking wet handkerchief, looked at Bob Chardoff and me and said if Lean walked off, it would be the end of MGM. There was a stockholders' fight with the Bronfmans of Seagram's, and this would give them the ammunition to take over, and he would be fired. At that point, I told O'Brien I wanted to talk to Nat Cohen in London, as I had a solution in mind. By now it was 4 p.m. in New York, 9 p.m. in London, and O'Brien's secretary reported that all the lines were down and she couldn't get through to London. O'Brien threw up his hands in despair and could only talk about the end of MGM and his job. I told the secretary to call the production manager in Madrid to have him call Cohen in London and have Cohen call me at O'Brien's office. Everyone looked at me, astonished. And I had to repeat to his secretary to please call Madrid. In just about 10 minutes, Cohen was on the phone from London. And I told him that rather than Christie flying to London to do the post-work on Darling, why not do it in Madrid at night? And MGM would pay for it. Cohen was more than agreeable. O'Brien was thrilled. And only Milnicker complained about MGM paying for Darling's post-work. O'Brien shut him up and said he had never seen anyone think on his feet like I did, and that's what he needed in Hollywood. He told Bob and me to find a script, and if he liked it, he'd make us producers for MGM in Culver City. A couple of days after the Julie Christie Dr. Zhivago affair, Russ Thatcher, head of the MGM story department in New York, called and had a script he thought would be a perfect vehicle for Christie. But he had a problem. O'Brien would only greenlight films after he read and liked the script. And Mr. O'Brien had a big stack on his desk and just wasn't getting around to reading them. Their productions were almost at a standstill. However, Thatcher said, O'Brien wanted us to produce films for MGM, so he would give us their script, and if we liked it, we would give it to Mr. O'Brien. In that case, there was a good chance he'd read it, and MGM would have a chance at making the film with Julie Christie. I read the script, Double Trouble. Didn't think it was very special, but with nothing to lose and figuring O'Brien would be eager for a Julie Christie film, I called him and pitched the script with the chance of Christie starring. He was receptive to reading it. Bright and early the next morning, O'Brien was on the phone, only he wasn't interested in making the film with Christie. He wanted to do it with Elvis Presley instead. I wasn't sure we were talking about the same script. I asked O'Brien if the script I'd sent him, Double Trouble, to star Julie Christie, was the one he wanted to do with Elvis Presley. He said, yes, what do you think of starring Presley instead of Julie Christie? I gulped hard and told O'Brien that it was a great idea, the best idea I'd heard in a long time. He said we should do a quick rewrite, change the female lead to a young male rock singer, and have Elvis sing a couple of songs.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?